We're going to begin Pirkei Avot tonight. And Masechet Avot is a tractate which sums up the good traits that our sages taught us. There are so many commentaries on this tractate that I spent about 2 weeks learning one after another. I started the first chapter and I couldn't decide which one was fit for us. And then I decided that we're going to learn the tractate in two ways. Firstly, tonight and the next few times, we'll quickly go over the whole tractate, Be'ezrat Hashem, so that everyone has a pshat, pashut pshat. We should have some simple understanding in the Mishnayot and Pirkei Avot. And then we will go over it, Be'ezrat Hashem, with more depth. Now, I'm going to try as we go through it to point out just a few instances of the depth, so we understand that there's a lot more to see in this tractate. This tractate is called Avot. Avot literally means fathers. And we have on tradition that all true philosophy and all true good traits and good behaviors, their source is here in this tractate Avot. And that's why Avot is called fathers, because it is, so to speak, the father of all books of good behavior. If you read any truth about how a person is supposed to behave anywhere else, you should know its source is here. When I was younger, over a decade ago, I started writing a book taking the philosophical works of different philosophers and showing how their works, the parts of their works that we agree with in Judaism, much of their what they saw as ingenious findings, we had already said in Pirkei Avot. Going with Confucius, going through all the generations, be it Brown or be it Lockheed, be it back to the time of Aristotle and Plato. The different works, if you learn Pirkei Avot with depth, then you see how these Mishnayot really have within them the messages that we were taught from different people. We can find really our sages taught us in Pirkei Avot. Now, when we learn this, sometimes we could think, okay, so this is a nice custom. Different nationalities, different peoples have different customs. And that's why our Masechet begins with reminding us that all of the oral law goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. We were given it at Sinai. It is not something that people deduced on their own. And before we begin this, we have to elaborate a little bit on this point, because this is a fundamental point in Jewish thought. We live in a time where many people, in their attempts to be pluralistic, people will speak about the fact that there are many truths and there are many good things, and we should be more accepting. If you ask someone, is there a parallel between good and truth, many people will say not, that good is based upon our perception. That is where modern philosophy has it nowadays. That we cannot prove, say the philosophers, what is good. So good is defined by society. And as such, there is no correlation between what is true and what is good. But rather, good is a term that is defined by society. And we do not believe that way. We believe that God created the world, and as part of creation, God created behaviors that are good and behaviors that are bad. And there are things that are intrinsically good and things that are intrinsically bad. And society can one day say that certain behaviors are good and we don't change. And another day they could say that other behaviors are bad and we don't change. Because our Torah is God-given, the one who created the world, and only He, can say what is really good. If it were left up to our whims, then we would have to say the way the rest of the world says, that good is defined by society. If those that signed on the Declaration of Independence themselves owned slaves, and they were attempting to be good people, but they believed that to be good was to own a slave. And if in the time of Greece, Plato writes that the epitome of being kind is that every man take a young child at his side, and when they're out at war, they have men go with men, and that's the epitome of good. So we see that at different times throughout the world history, different acts were believed to be good. go back 100 years ago, and in Russia, a man who was attracted to other men would be put in an insane asylum. What happened? The world changed. At one point, a thousand... It's still that way? Okay. So, you go back a millennium, and the world was looking at it two millennium, and the world said, this is the ideal good. You go today, and the world says, that's crazy. So what is good? We say, there is a good. When the world was rampant, and the world was going after the power of the sword, be it the Greek philosophy, the Roman philosophy, we maintained our belief of what is good and what is bad. We had the same treatment of women. Women were treated in Judaism like they were treated nowhere else. And to this day that is so. We had our treatment of Gerim long before Napoleon, long before Alexander the Great. Before there was uniform law in Judaism, we had a special mitzvah of how to treat Gerim. Before such concept existed anywhere else. Before the concept of democracy pervaded the world, in Judaism we had the concept of Acharei Rabim Na'atot, you go by the majority opinion. Judaism taught us and continues to teach us what is truly good. And when we approach this Masechet, we have to know that this Masechet begins with our tradition, reminding us that the Torah goes back to Moshe, to Sinai, to Hashem who gave to us at Sinai, because this Masechet, which is going to teach us what are good behaviors, is also on tradition from Moshe, from Sinai. It is not the conclusion of a few wise individuals, but rather a tradition that we have going back to Sinai. And if our Mishnayot are going to quote certain traits as the sayings of certain rabbis, all that means is that the rabbis used to stress this point. But it does not mean that the rabbis stressed this point to the exclusion of the others. But rather, the traits that we learn in this Masechet were the tradition that we had. And the Mishnah quotes, this rabbi used to stress this to his students, and that rabbi used to stress that. But all these traits, nitenu meroi echad, were given from one shepherd, from Hashem to Moshe at Sinai. And with that, let's begin the first chapter, the first Mishnah. Moshe kibel Torah mi-Sinai. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai. Now, the Mishnah is going to continue and tell us how the Torah was passed down. But let's take an example, just to see a little bit of the depth that one can see when one learns the Mishnayot. The tractate begins with Moshe. Who was Moshe? The greatest prophet. The person who had the best traits in the world. We know that in order to attain prophecy, one must have the best traits. The better one's traits, the higher the level of prophecy. Moshe, the one who was so humble, the one who had the greatest traits, he was fit to receive the Torah. And on a different occasion, we have to explain what the word kibel means. The word kabbalah, what does it mean to accept? And what does the word Torah mean? The word Torah has multiple meanings. From Sinai. Really, he accepted it from God who appeared on Sinai. God chose Sinai because it was the humble mountain, the smaller mountain. Sarah. Moshe gave it over to his disciple, to Yoshua. Now, really, Moshe Rabbeinu taught all of the Jewish people, as we discussed, but Yoshua was the one student who gave up his life for Torah. Day and night, he'd always be in the Beis Medrash. When everyone left, and it was the end of the day, and everyone was tired, he'd rearrange the seats so that it would be ready for the next class. So Yoshua, who put all his strength into it, he was the one who received the tradition from Moshe. He was the one that received the leadership. The Yoshua and Yoshua gave it over, Lizkenim, to the elders. Those are the elders who were beaten on behalf of the Jewish people. They were the ones who were responsible for groups of Jews in Egypt. And the Egyptian policemen would say, you ensure that they fulfill their quota, and if not, you get beaten. And what did the Egyptians do? The first day that the Jews came to work, everyone was fresh, everyone had strength, everyone had slept well the night before, they had good meals, everyone worked hard, and then the Egyptians wrote down how much each person did, and they said, okay, now each of you have to keep up this work, and they made them work day and night, and they added labor, and they made them work under circumstances that they really didn't have much food to eat, and they didn't have much sleep, but they always had to keep up that quota. And then they made these Jewish policemen, and they say, you ensure they do this quota, here's a whip, whip them if you have to, and what they don't do, you'll get whipped. And the Jewish policemen would get whipped, but would not beat the Jewish people. And these policemen, because of this act of kindness, were chosen to be the elders, and those are the elders that Yoshua passed the Torah to. Now these elders did not live out the year past when Yoshua died, because when Yoshua died, they eulogized him, but they didn't eulogize him well enough. They didn't put enough strength into it. And God said, the great leader Yeshua died. And you just give him a power of eulogy? God held it against the Zkenim. The elders said, we're busy with Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. We have to settle the land of Israel. It's a big mitzvah. God said, yes, it's a big mitzvah, but you should have stopped that big mitzvah to worry about the other mitzvah of giving Yeshua the proper honor. And I often quote this to guys, because guys, Baruch Hashem, they learn about the mitzvah of coming to Eretz Yisrael when they come to Machon Meir, and sometimes they get carried away. They forget that there are many mitzvot, and sometimes we're not allowed to trample other mitzvot in order to do this mitzvah. Just like the elders were held accountable for trampling the mitzvah of giving Yeshua the proper eulogy, so to a person who tramples over his wife's feelings or other mitzvot in order to do Yishuv Eretz Yisrael might also be held accountable. So Yeshua gave over the tradition to the elders. Zkenim Ninviim, the elders gave it over to the prophets that led the Jewish people. And then it went from prophet to prophet to prophet until we reached the men of the great assembly in the beginning of the second temple. When Vim Esarola and Sheikh Nesta Gdola, they gave it over to the men of the great assembly. We know that in Sheikh Nesta Gdola were 120 elders. They composed one version of prayer, our Shmona Esrei. They composed the blessings that we say. They instituted many, many institutions. They really are the ones that ensured that Torah remained within the Jewish people. When Ezra came back to the land of Israel, he found the Jews doing business on Shabbos. Many of the Jews had intermarried. Ezra had the power by the king to institute, so to speak, martial law. Ezra told the people, you got to leave your foreign wives, the non-Jewish women that you married. People weren't too happy about it. So Ezra sent his men out and told them, pull out their beards, pull out their hair, beat them up until they listen. Ezra had the power to do that. He had a very powerful court. The king gave him the power. And Ezra didn't only solve the problem for that generation. Ezra made institutions to solve the problem for future generations. One of his institutions was that peddlers would go from city to city to sell perfume and stuff to make the women more beautiful. Why were the men attracted to the non-Jewish women? Because the Jewish women didn't have the perfumes and stuff. They weren't so attractive. So Ezra said, okay, women, get yourself attractive. So he had the peddlers go around and sell the stuff that would help the women get beautiful. So the men of the great assembly, we call them the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, because they returned the crown to what it used to be. The Jewish people, when they underwent the destruction of the temple, evolved that the prophet said, we could no longer say, as Moshe Rabbeinu said, God is the great, powerful, awesome one. And Yirmiyah and Daniel, each one removed one of God's descriptions till they removed the mighty one. They said, we don't see the might, the temple's destroyed. We don't see the awesome one. God's people are scattered and trampled among the nations. Came the men of the great assembly and said, irrespective of whether we're on our holy land or not, whether we have the temple built or not, the fact that God ensures that one nation remains intact among so many nations that want to destroy it, that itself shows God's might, that itself shows the awe of God. And they said, we always say, as we say in Shmona Esrei, Hakel HaGadol HaGibor VaNora, God who is mighty, God who is great, God who is awesome. We use those descriptions even at the time of the greatest destruction, because even within the greatest destruction, we can see these attributes of God. Now, it's interesting that the men of the great assembly instituted many things, and yet for this one point, the fact that they returned, so to speak, the crown to God, they called God great and mighty, even at a time of destruction, they are called the men of the great assembly. That's why they got that title. For all their other institutions, we would value them, but we wouldn't give them this title. They're called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola because of this. And these men of the great assembly who were at the period, the beginning of the second temple, Hem Amu Shlosha Dvarim, they said three things that they warned us about, that they are fundamental for maintaining the Torah. Hevu Metunim Badin, be patient when it comes to giving a judicial decision. Someone comes to you and asks you a shayla, asks you, can I walk with a cane and shoe? A woman once came up to me in the street and asked me, can I walk with a cane and shoe? So my first thought was, yeah, what's the problem? And only afterwards I realized her question was, can I walk with a cane to shul? And she was asking the question in New York City, where you had a Rosh Hashanah. So a person has to be patient, a person has to wait and think before he gives a decision in justice. And this applies to any ruling. Very often we think, oh, I know the answer to that. We have to stop and be patient and think and then give the answer. And sometimes it means waiting a day or two. Be patient, they said. And this they instructed the greatest rabbis. Ve'hamidu talmidim arbe, and erect many students. We know Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students and they didn't last. It was only his last 5 or 7 students that maintained the oral law. All 24,000 passed away now in this period between Pesach and Lag BaOmer. And that's why we have the custom to learn these Mishnayot at this time, because those 24,000 passed away because they didn't behave with good enough midot to one another. So we try to improve our midot and we learn these Mishnayot. So they said, one, be patient in giving a ruling. Two, establish many students. And this is a rule in life. Sometimes a person feels accomplished. A person can sometimes sit on his laurels and say, I've done mine. I brought 5 children to the world. I've taught 15 students, 200 students. I've put 500 shiurim online. I've done my job. Chazal say no. A person has to know. If you brought children when you were young, bring children when you're old. If you taught students when you were young, teach students when you're old. You never know what will succeed. When it comes to making money, a person doesn't say, I made $500,000. I'm okay for the next 5 years. I haven't seen anyone say that. We should probably say that when it comes to money. We should probably say, I've made enough money for a few years. Let me go learn Torah. But when it comes to money, people don't say that. They say, I made $500,000. Let me make another $500,000. When it comes to worldly things, we're always interested in getting more. Chazal said, when it comes to godly things, we have to know that we don't know which will be successful. The person doesn't know which of his children will succeed. You could never know. And our sages said, when we teach our students, they called it ha'amidu. Stand, make stand many students. That means you have to teach a student and help him until he's standing on his own 2 feet. Every person has to know, I'll get you in a second, Anshil. We have to know that there's a limit to how much we could help someone. You could teach, you could educate when it comes to our children or our talmidim, but at the end of the day, just like we have our own free choice, they have their own free choice. But we have to bring them to a point where they're standing and they could hopefully make the right decisions. That doesn't mean they will. They may not, but we have to bring them to a point where they're standing and can make their own decisions and make the right decisions. And a person isn't supposed to feel like, I did enough when I taught 10 or 1,000 or 24,000 students. A person's always supposed to keep trying. And that's the second lesson they taught us, Ha'amidu talmidim arbe, erect many students. Yeah.
The point
you said is brought in halacha. You're correct in the point you made. This is discussed in halacha that if a person feels like if he brings more children, he will not be able to educate them properly, then that can be a reason why, let's say a person is 75 and his wife passed away, he shouldn't go crazy to find a 30-year-old in order to bring more children to the world. Then we'd say, okay, so find another 70-year-old you can marry. You don't have to go crazy to marry a woman. No. This is an important example because halachically we say, let's say a person is 60 years old and he lost his wife. So he already brought children to the world. He has enough money to marry a woman who cannot have children. He has enough money to marry a woman who's 45, 50, and they'll live happily. He also has a Sefer Torah, which we use. Do we say, let's sell that Sefer Torah so he has enough money to marry a woman who can have children? Ordinarily, we don't sell Sefer Torah almost for anything. We have a rule. Ma'alim b'kodesh v'en moridim. When it comes to things of holiness, you always got to move one up. So Sefer Torah is the holiest it gets. You can't move one up from there. So the only reason we sell Sefer Torah is maybe a Jew's out as a hostage and you need money to bail him out. That's the one exception. Another exception, the halacha says, is if this old man, by selling the Sefer Torah, will be able to marry a woman who could bring more children to the world, as opposed to marrying a woman who could not have more children, for that we would sell the Sefer Torah. That's how much we value being able to bring more children. A person, if he can, should try to bring more children. But at the same time, if a person feels like he's not up to educating those children, then that would be a good reason why he shouldn't necessarily marry a woman who can have children. But that would be a discussion to speak to his rabbi. You'll note, I did not discuss birth control here. Birth control is a separate question. We discussed whether you marry this type of woman or that type of woman. We did not discuss birth control because that's a totally separate parsha. That's a separate discussion. Yeah. Well, you'll notice I did not mention a number. As far as numbers, each person is going to have to speak to his local Orthodox rabbi. I didn't say have 24,000 children. I said 24,000 students. When it comes to children, that's a different question. We have a responsibility to educate each child. Again, the question of birth control is a complicated question. People are way too lenient with it. Halakhically, they don't realize the severity, the weight of this question. At the same time, there is a question that needs to be dealt with, and each person will discuss it with his local Orthodox rabbi.
I didn't ask about birth control.
No. I didn't think that's what you were asking. I just don't think I said anything about how many children you should have, so I'm not sure what you want them to tell the girls at seminary.
No, I mean, do they try and promote
I don't know what's taught at seminaries. And the last thing, Nanjek Nestak Dorat Torah, is Vasu Siag La Torah, make extra fences for the Torah. And one of the questions we're going to ask ourselves throughout this tractate is, who were they talking to? We're going to learn that they're talking to us. But we have to realize that some of these things seem to indicate that they're talking to the rabbis. Meaning, can each person make his own fence? How do we apply this halachically? Or was this an instruction to the rabbis? Rabbis of the next generations, you make fences. Another question we're going to have to ask, and again we're going to leave it hanging until we learn with more depth, on what level is this Masechet talking to us? We know that there are things that every Jew is responsible to do. Halakha. We know there are things that when you're pious, then you do. That could be a chassid, sadiq, vatik. There are different levels of piety. Who is this tractate talking to? Is the tractate teaching me what every Jew must do? Or is the tractate teaching me what I should do? How I become a better person? Again, we're going to leave this question hanging. Bezrat Hashem, when we go through the tractate again, we will try to bring the halachic applications of the Mishnayot and discussing where each thing lands. For now, we're just going to take the messages and try to learn from it. Now, what does it mean make a border for the Torah? I always tell guys, once you got engaged, you should know that the laws of Yichud are not enough. The laws of Yichud tell us, don't allow yourself to be in a situation where you're alone with a girl and something may happen. So, we know the laws, you're not allowed to be alone in a room, you're not allowed to be in a place where no one might show up. But when you're with someone who you got engaged to, so then, I hope, the emotions are strong. So then you have to take extra precautions, you go beyond that. If we know that we're not supposed to show extra affection to someone of the opposite gender, so if we're a guest at someone's house, we'll take precautions beyond the letter of the law. Of course we're shomer negiah, we know we're not allowed to touch someone of the opposite gender. What about things beyond that? So this goes into the area where we know there's the law, and then every person has to think of what fences to make for himself. So a person might say, I know if I walk down this street, I'll see immodest things. I'll go down the other street. There are many applications. What each application is, the law, the general guideline we have. A person has to remember, don't go up to the fence. You know, there used to be a game when I was a kid. I don't remember what it was called. Chicken, I think it was called. Guys used to go, teenagers, drive towards a cliff and screech to a halt. And the winner was the one who would screech to a halt closest to the cliff.
And
the
loser's
the loser, right, went down the cliff. So you think about it, it's insane. You know how many kids died in this game? I mean, people really got killed in this game. So the Torah is telling us the same thing. The Torah is telling us, when you're playing, when the Torah tells you don't do something, don't go screeching to a halt near the edge of the cliff. Take steps back, make yourself fences. Don't go to the edge. So we have to remember this. Every person has to know his area. You know, a guy once came to my house, Erev Rosh Hashanah, a few years ago, and he said to me, I don't know how to tell you this, but I was going out, and I was, and he had just landed at the Machon. He just came from Chutz Arts. He said, I was in the airport waiting, and I went into McDonald's, and I sat and had a burger. And it's Erev Rosh Hashanah, and I just landed, and I think back, and I was in McDonald's, and I had the burger. So I had non-kosher meat with milk. I made a motzi, he said. I made a bracha. But when I sat there, I forgot that I was supposed to eat kosher. So what can you say to a guy that he was used to eating non-kosher and he was learning about Judaism, and then he learned, hey, I'm not supposed to eat this. So a guy like that, we tell him, wait a second. So now you have to think, what's the fence that fits for you? How do you ensure that you don't eat in a place where the food is non-kosher? I hope that everyone at the Mahon doesn't have that issue. So we have to think, what are our issues? Where do we have to make the fences? But we have to make the fences. Mishnah Bet. And we're continuing with the tradition. The first chapter goes in the order of the rabbis, the chronological order. Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik. Now, you'll notice that Chazal, when they use terms like HaTzadik, HaKadosh, they are specific terms and they are specific titles that were given to specific people because they merited those titles. So Shimon, who was known as Shimon HaTzadik, Hayam Misharei Knesset HaGdola, he was left over from the men of the Great Assembly. He was the last one left alive from them. And he was one of them, but he was the last one left alive. He used to frequently say, Al Shoshah Dvarim Olam Amid. The world was created for three things. There are three things the world stands on. Ala Torah, on Torah. Every person has no ever responsibility to learn Torah. Torah is one of the three legs the world stands on. Then Avodah, and on the service, which is in the time the temple is the service of the temple. In our time it's the service of prayer. V'al'gmilut chasadim, and on acts of kindness. Olam, the world, chesed yibaneh. The kindness is what builds it. And I want to stress this point here, because in the Machon we're focused on learning Torah. And we have to know that Torah is very, very important. But Torah chesed al-leshona, we say in Eishes Chayil. The Torah is a Torah of kindness. And the Torah has to show itself in the way we behave to other people. So one of the three points the world stands on is gmilut chasadim, acts of kindness. That includes when someone's sitting shiva, we visit shiva. When someone's having a wedding, we go and make the chatan happy. When someone is ill, we check what he needs. You know how many times guys here have a brit milah, and I call up and I come over and I'm the one that brings them supper and I'm the one that brings them the medication? Now, I don't mind, I'm happy, I'm honored to do the mitzvah. But I'm always shocked. Wait a second, there's a whole machon. These are everyone's friends. The friends should be coming in and seeing what the guy needs. Now, again, I don't mind. I'm very happy to do it. I just feel bad because I feel like I'm taking your guys' mitzvah. One of the three things we have to work on is gmilut chasadim. And the other is Torah and Avodah. And Avodah, we shouldn't forget either. It's prayer. Now, a word on prayer. Sometimes people think I have to focus all prayer. Yeah, you should focus all prayer. See if you could do it. Most people have a very hard time with it. So the tip I always give that I found works for me is take small segments. Work for a few days or a week on one sentence in tefillah. Take one sentence in Shmona Esrei and decide, this sentence I'll focus. The rest, and when you finish that sentence, now I can zone out, okay, I won't focus. Fine. I should focus, I'll try to focus. But at least have one sentence. And each week work on a different sentence. And you'll see that slowly it'll build your tefillah. We're up to the third Mishnah. Antignos ish Socho kibem Shimon Tzadik. Antigone, the important man of the city of Socho, he got his tradition from Shimon HaTzadik. Hu hayomer, he used to frequently say, al tiyuk ha'avadim hamshamshim trav al menat lekabel pras. Do not be like those slaves that their service of the master is because they're constantly expecting a reward. El ha'avuk ha'avadim hamshamshim trav shelo al menat lekabel pras. But rather be like the slaves that when they serve their master, they do it not for the sake of the reward, they just do it because they love the master. You love a master, so you do what you can for him. So you might think it's enough to serve out of love. He says, no. You also have to have the aspect of fear. V'hi mora shamayim aleichem. Don't think you should only serve the Creator out of love. Chazal taught us, avod mi'ira ve'avod ma'ava. Personal service has to be both out of love and out of fear. Why? Because when you love someone, so let's say your mother sends you to the store and she says, I want three potatoes. You come to the store and all the potatoes are rotten. So if you're not so happy with your mother, you might come back and say, Ma, the store was all out of potatoes. I'm sorry, the potatoes were all rotten. But if you're working out of love, then you say, wait a second, let me check if the store down the block has better potatoes. And when they don't have potatoes, you say, but maybe I'll get from somewhere else. And when you don't find potatoes, you come home and you say, Ma, I went to three stores they didn't have, but if you're not in a rush, maybe I'll go to a fourth store, maybe I'll go knock by a neighbor and find it. When we do the positive, the proactive, the asay, the mitzvot asay, that's where if we have love, then we do more. We do more completely. When we buy an esrog, we could say, well, how much do I have to spend on an esrog? This is a pretty nice esrog, so I'll buy an esrog for 50 shekel. Or you could say, wait, let me see, maybe I can get a better one for 60 or 65 or 70. So next week I won't buy that milkshake. I won't buy the pack of cigarettes. But I'll have a nicer esrog. That's where love comes in. But what happens when you're on the internet and suddenly something comes up that you shouldn't look at? So when you love, so your mother says, do me a favor, son. Tomorrow morning, don't take the car. I'm going to need it. I don't want you out on it. But you want to just hop over to the store and pick up a pack of cigarettes. Or, good, no one here smokes. So you want to hop to the store and see who won the Knicks game last night. Or the soccer game last night. I assume you don't have Knicks in Greece. So you think to yourself, no, I love my mother. She told me, but what happens? I'll go for a second. When it comes to love, love is not a preventative. Love can help us do more positively the positive that we do. But the preventative is if your mother yells at you and you know she's going to have a fit if you dare take that car when she told you not to, that's a preventative. Fear ensures that we obey the lotase, the prohibitions. So that's why the Mishnah says, on the one hand, serve the Creator, not for the sake of the reward, serve out of love. On the other hand, don't think that's enough to serve out of love. Fear also has to be there, because that balance is what ensures that we maintain our service. Our sages worded it this way. Avod me'ava, serve out of love. Avod me'ira, serve out of fear. Avod me'ava, serve out of love. Shim bata lisno. For if you come to hate, dashe ata ohev, you'll remember you love. Ven ohev sone. And if a lover doesn't hate. Avod me'ira, work out of fear. Shim bata livot. If you came to kick, you're fed up with it, dashe ata yare. You'll know you're scared. Ve'en yare boet. And a person who's scared doesn't dare kick back. So, the Mishnah taught us the importance of serving Hashem both out of love and out of fear. This is an important point, not to serve for the sake of a reward. But it was misunderstood by Antigonus' disciples. Antigonus didn't say there is no reward. Antigonus said, don't work for the sake of reward. It's interesting to note that the Rambam in his introduction, the Rambam says that this is the highest level. The Rambam in the introduction to the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin, of Perek Chelek, the Rambam says that this is a very high level, that the greatest rabbis don't attain this level. All of us have to feel like we're going to get something around the bend. When we serve, at one point a child does mitzvot, you tell him he'll be a good boy, he'll get a piece of chocolate, and then you tell him he'll get a nice suit, and then you tell him he'll get nice shoes, and then you tell him he'll be the best in his class, and then you tell him I'll give you money, and then you tell him you'll be called a rabbi, and then the Rambam says you tell him you'll be called chief rabbi. Seems like even when he's a rabbi, you've got to give him the incentive that he'll be chief rabbi in order to keep learning. So it seems like even at the level of a rabbi, and even on the higher levels, this level isn't yet attained. This is where we're supposed to aspire, but the Rambam seems to indicate that it is not attainable by most people. It is not attained by most people. Mishnah Dalet. Yosef and Yezer Ish Tzredav, Yosef and Yochanan Ish Ushalayim Kiblu Mehem. Yossi, the son of Uezer, who was the important man in the city of Tzereda, and Yossi, the son of Yochanan, who was the important man in the city of Jerusalem, they received the tradition from them, from Antigone and from Shimon. Yosef and Uezer, Omer Yosef, the son of Uezer, instructed the following to his disciples. Yehi betcha betvad l'chachamim. Your house should be a place where the rabbis are happy together. When they have to have a parlor meeting, and the rabbis want to know where to go, so, you know, very often when guys meet, they say, okay, we'll have a meeting, and everyone says, your place. So Yosef and Yezer said, yeah, a person should always say, yeah, my place. If you could have the rabbis by you, you gain from it. And try to absorb the dust at their feet. Sometimes we're on the level where we could learn from the rabbis. Sometimes we're on level where we can't learn from them. But we could learn from their behaviors. We could at least sit there and absorb the dust of their feet. And if a person's on a level where he feels like, I won't understand what they're talking about, but at least you can see how they behave. I used to go to Rav Kapach Zatzal's shir. Now, Rav Kapach was an interesting Jew. He came from Yemen. He was orphaned at a very young age. His grandfather was a big rabbi in Yemen. And when he came to Israel, so he became a big rabbi here. He translated and worked on many, many amazing works. Among the things he authored himself was a commentary on the Rambam. So he used to give a class in his own work. The only difficulty with this class was that he'd speak like they'd speak in ancient Yemen, where the tough would sometimes be a th, and a dalid would be a th, and their whole accent, Gimel, could be a Gimel or a Gimel. And I sat there the first class, and I didn't even realize he was talking Hebrew. I thought he was talking Arabic. So I sat through the whole class, and I didn't. After a few classes, I started catching on to his way of speech, and I usually was able to get about 50% of the class. But one thing I got a lot from, after class, no one would walk him home. So I'd walk him home, and in walking him home, I saw so many things about the way he behaved. I learned things for a lifetime. Sometimes we're not on a level where we could learn what the rabbi is saying. But if we stay close to him, we'll still get from it. So the Mishnah is telling us, make your home available for them. And if you can, even it be at their dust, the dust of their feet. Ve'eveh shoteh v'tzamati v'him, and drink their words out of thirst. When a person comes to learn, a person could sit back and say, ah, another class. Okay. Or a person could walk in and be eager and thirsty. And the Mishnah is telling us that we have to work on ourselves to drink it as though we're thirsty. And if we approach the class that way, then we'll absorb it that way. Mishnah Hey, Yosef and Yochanan Yishushalayim Omer, Yosef the son of Yochanan, the important man of Jerusalem, used to say, Yivetcha patuch lirvacha, your house should always be wide open. People should feel comfortable coming to your house. You should have guests frequently. Ve'yuanim nevetecha, and when you have the option of either buying a servant or giving a person a job that will work in your home, give him a job. The best type of charity is giving a person a job. So yiyu aniyim, the poor people should be bnei beitecha, they should be the workers in your house. You can give a guy a job, take a poor person, give him the job. And here I want to make a point. We have a special mitzvah, okano miyad amitecha. Where we can, we should purchase from a fellow Jew. Firstly, we have to be careful with that. You have a choice of which taxi to take, try to take a Jew. You have a choice of which painter to take, try to take a Jew. Of course, there are halachot, but how much you have to lose for that. But wherever you can, a person should try to hire Jewish. But then there's another point. The biggest stucco we could do is help a person with panasa. Everyone here is going to have a period, after you leave the machon, where you're going to try to build your own panasa. You might choose to be a painter, an artist, a photographer, whatever it is. We have to try to help one another out. This is the greatest chesed that we could do. Because that's not tzedakah. We all need help at some point. So when we were getting married, my in-laws found a place that they make the benches. They hire people who are handicapped to make the benches. So I won't tell you that there weren't more mistakes than we'd expect from another place. So we proofread. So it involved a little bit more work. So we proofread the benches once. Not the benches, the invitations. And we proofread it twice. And when the final printing was about to go out, there was still a mistake there, and we caught it, and they fixed it. But you know what? At the end of the day, these people who can't get a job anywhere else are able to get a job. Now, this applies to people who are handicapped, but it also applies to your fellow man, your fellow guy in the machon. Where we can, this is what Yosef ben Yochanan is teaching us. Help another guy out. Give him the job. And don't chit-chat too much with a woman. With your own wife, our sages said that. Certainly one's friend's wife. And from here, from this directive that a person shouldn't chit-chat too much with the women, our sages taught us, whenever a person indulges in chit-chat with a woman, he's harming himself. At that time he could be learning Torah. He's wasting from learning Torah. And ultimately he will inherit perdition. Now, these people, for some reason, have difficulty with this section of the Mishnah, and I don't know why. The Mishnah doesn't say don't talk to your wife. The Mishnah doesn't say don't discuss things with your wife or don't spend time with your wife. The Mishnah is talking about sicha, chit-chat. And even this, they say that the first year of marriage, this doesn't apply. The first year, even the chit-chat is building the home. After that, so you have to figure out how much is appropriate and how much is what our sages told us, not too much. And when I got married, so I asked a few big rabbis this question, and they all gave me the same answer. They said, as much as you and she need, that's not too much. Mishnah Vav, Yoshua ben Prachya Nitai Arbeli kidlu mehem. Yoshua, the son of Prachya and Nitai from the city of Arbel, they received their tradition from Yosi ben Yezer and Yosi ben Yochanan. Yoshua ben Chachia omer, Yoshua ben Chachia used to frequently say, Asei lecha rav, establish for yourself a Rebbe. Sometimes a person says, but he's not as big as I'd want my Rebbe to be. No, you have to have a Rebbe. A person without a Rebbe is a person without an anchor. Once a person doesn't have a Rebbe, he always has to rely on himself. Now that means he's going to do one of two things. Either he'll be too stringent, because I don't know, so I have to be stringent, or he'll be too lenient, because I don't know, it must be okay. Whichever way he goes, it isn't good. So the instruction is, find a Rebbe. If you don't find as big a Rebbe as you'd like, still find a Rebbe. Wherever you are, a person should always try to find a Rebbe, and he knows that he asks him the question, and whatever he says, that's what he does. Ukne lecha chaver, and acquire for yourself a friend. Notice it's called acquiring because it involves investment. Part of being a friend is giving. And a person has to invest in a friendship. That means keeping up with a friend, taking the time to listen to a friend. It's something we have to acquire, and every person should know this is very, very important. If a person wants to go through life without friends, he's not going through life, he's going through death. O chavruta o mituta. Our sages taught us, a healthy human being, his life is with this motto, either friends or death. A person cannot live without friends. Now, if we have females in the audience, this applies especially for females, but this applies to males and females as well. People sometimes think when they get married that they don't need friends. And that is a mistake. What is true is that in the beginning of marriage, we need to separate from our friends to build our own nest. The couple needs time alone, and friends can sometimes ruin the relationship. And we have to be careful that friends aren't harmful to the relationship. But at the end of the day, after we've taken the year or two or three or however long it takes to invest within our home, men will need their male friends and women will need their female friends. Men remain men and women remain women. And as much as a person's best friend may be his wife, but a person also needs his friends. There's a beautiful pshat over here that says that the friend over here is referring to a sefer, to a book that we learned. Now, this isn't pasha pshat, but it's worth remembering that sometimes, if there's no one around to talk to, then the good books can very often be the friend that helps us maintain our sanity. So, although this isn't pshat, it's a pshat that's worth remembering. Vehevedan et kol adam lekafschut, and one should judge every good person favorably. If you see a good person and you see him doing something that could be judged either way, so judge him favorably. We're going to pause here for tonight and go over to our binyan abayit.